Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 80 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2 Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off week 16 is DJ Valentine from Simplistics Reviews. Welcome back to the show, DJ.
It's been a pleasure. This entire week has been a pleasure, except for the fact that William Sadler isn't in more scenes this season. As long as I love me some William Sadler, that's the only thing I miss. I want more Sadler. More Sadler.
No, I understand that, but see if you can get an ETV that'll settle him down a little bit.
An ATV.
All right. So minute 80 begins with the parachute continuing to descend and ends with Holly eyeing Thornburg suspiciously. So yesterday we ended things with a spectacular explosion that John was able to somehow get out of. You know, he was able to. So earlier this week, I didn't mention, in the commentary of this movie by Rennie Harlan. So he mentioned some very interesting things that I just want to point out that I missed through the course of this week. Right. First of all, when they shoot into the cockpit from inside the plane, you know, where we saw all those dents. So apparently they made those dents with a hammer, meaning that someone was standing there hammering it in order to look as if it was the bullets, making those dents. Okay. Another interesting thing is he states that in this particular plane, there is no ejection seat, but they decided to bend reality a little bit in order for it to work.
I figured
here.
It seemed like a plane that would not have an ejection seat. Well, I'll take it.
Yeah. Okay. And so he mentions that they did this not on a green screen, they did it on a blue screen at ILM. You know, they went down to ILM and had them take care of shooting Bruce Willis, you know, just sitting in a chair and moving the camera back and forth, and then they were able to create that. And the best part of trivia that I gleaned from listening to this is that the car that the bad guys used is actually Rennie Harlan's car. Because when they filmed the scene, they realized that they didn't have a car. So Rennie volunteered to let them use his car. And he said he got really upset because they scratched it. And he said, but that's a story for another day, which is pretty upsetting because I would have loved to have heard that story. You know,
so wait, Rennie Harlan's using his own car on the set of the movie he's directing. They can't give him like a rental car or something.
Apparently they realized, you know, they set it up and they're like, hey, wait a second, we don't have a car.
Rennie Harlan's like, he directs movies like a guy goes to like a construction worker going to work. It's like, let me get in my car, drive to work. Rennie, we got all the, we could rent a car, Uber, taxi. We'll send a car for you. No. I'm driving my own car.
No, okay. But you do realize this was his first big budget movie. So, you know.
Yeah, but he's a director of the sequel to Die Hard. I'm pretty sure Fox will give him a car.
Apparently not.
I mean, maybe not. I mean, they were sold, but whatever.
He apparently used his own, so what can
Rupert
you do?
Murdoch was like, no. You drive your own car. We can't afford. We got to cut the budget, all right? Get out of here.
It's very possible. You never know. So basically, you know, we see the parachute start coming down from the sky. And then in the distance, we see the five fire trucks that scared away the bad guys yesterday getting closer. You know, we can still hear their sirens, blazing. And then John lands on the ground and does another roll. Like he did on Monday, he showed that he is a good gymnast. You know, he somehow has this parachute all around him. I'm still confused how he got the parachute, you know, all around him, because we see that he's buckled under his, you know, between his legs also. Did he strap himself in to the parachute that way? Or I thought he had strapped himself into the seat.
I just saw his arms. I didn't see him do anything with legs. So, yeah, that's weird. I don't understand how that works.
Yeah, I don't know either. We're gonna have to go back and look at yesterday's minutes, see if we saw that. But I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I think that's another one of those suspension of the. How does a parachute on a parachute on an ejector seat that doesn't exist on that plane actually work? We'll never know.
Well, how does it work on any plane? Let's put it that way. Is the pilot wearing a you know, is the pilot always strapped in to a parachute, or is the parachute?
I think it's he's strapped to the chair. Oh, now I don't know.
Right. So he's strapped to the chair.
I'm thinking of like,
and then we see him, you know, strap around his waist, but it looks like he's strapping himself into the chair. You know, we don't see. I don't know. Maybe part of the strap goes into the parachute itself.
The chair must fall away eventually, I'm assuming, because you're not landing in the chair. You're landing with your feet.
Right. So it's somehow...
Independence Day, he ejects, but then he lands on his feet. I remember that.
Right.
I think the chair falls away. I think I'm looking at pictures of an ejector seat, people using it, and I think the chair falls away, but your arms, the parachute's attached to your arms. So it's almost like you fly up, the seat shoots you up, and then as soon as you start making your descent, the chair drops out from under you, but the chute keeps you up, so you separate from the seat on the way down. From what I'm looking at this picture, that's what looks like what's going on. I'm
okay, 95%. That's fair. It's fair enough.
I'll never find out because I'm not getting in any ejector seat anytime soon.
Yeah, I have no plans.
I don't want to know.
I have no plans either to do that. So yeah,
keep them away from me.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that one either. Neither one of us is going to be testing this out. But if any of our guests out there, you know, if any of the listeners want to test out the theory and let us know, or if any of you are experienced,
I'm not condoning it. I'm not condoning it. This drive, use a train. Don't use any jets.
Don't use an ejector seat. That's what you're saying.
Jets. Don't use any jets. Just travel some other way. Use a bus. Okay. Get some bus fare on your system.
It's very possible. All right. And, you know, John then starts rolling around on the ground, and then the parachute lands on top of him. And I love this ADR line that comes out here. We hear John go, "Where's the door?"
I'm literally looking at a diagram as we're speaking here. It's an 8-step diagram on how an ejection seat works. So I was right. It shoots you up. The parachute is attached to you. The seat falls away on step 6, and then you go down with the parachute. So yeah, you're with the chair for a little while, then the chair leaves you, and then you fold down. That's how it works. Okay, don't ask where the seat is. We don't know. It's probably somewhere in the airport at this point.
It's very possible.
I do like "Where's the f***er?" That's a very good, very good 80-yard line. If you're going to 80-yard line, make it a funny one, and that's a funny one.
That's right. It makes sense. And so, actually, I had a little bit of trivia questions to ask you about parachutes. Okay, we're not going to get into the history of parachutes and stuff like that.
I know everything about them now. I look at the diagram. I know everything about them. Go ahead.
Great. Do you know the what's the world's record for the highest parachute jump?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so
I know everything else. Right, good. Everything good. Else.
Well,
I know.
We'll get there. So in 1960, a man named Joseph Kittinger jumped from a balloon at the altitude of 102,000 feet.
Why? Why would you do that?
And he fell for 4 minutes and 36 seconds and still holds, after 63 years, the world's record for the longest parachute free fall.
Guys, you know how long 4 minutes is?
That's right.
That's a long time. That's a long, long time. Like 30, count to 10, guys. One.
Yes.
You're falling now. Imagine you're screaming. Ah!
Two. They say his entire descent took 13 minutes and 45 seconds.
Remember that scene in Thor Ragnarok where Doctor Strange makes Loki like fall? He goes, "I've been falling for 30 minutes. That's what it feels like, what you just described.
It's very possible. You never know.
Oh, man. Oh, no. I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
Well, you don't have to like it.
No.
Nobody's forcing you to do it.
He chose that. He chose that. Somebody, it wasn't like he was flying a plane. Like, I got to make a decision. No. That sounds like something he set up to do. Why?
That's right.
Why would you do that? Why would you do that?
We're giving you a choice. What do you want to do? Hey, I want to jump 100,000 feet. you know, free fall. And
we're gonna give you money, but I guess sure.
Well, no, you got to give him you got to give him credit for the fact that, you know, after 63 years, there isn't anyone stupider to try to, you know, try to beat him.
Nobody's gonna break that record. Not a lot of stupid people. Oh, sorry. There are a lot of stupid people. There's a thousand stupid people, but not a lot of stupid people that are, you know, got with the ingenuity to do what he did.
Correct. That is true.
Because they're stupid.
That is very true. They are not the brightest people around, and therefore, yeah. Yeah. So all right, we'll skip the stupid people. we'll move on. We're just gonna move along here. So John, you know, tries to figure out how to get out of this parachute, and he's not so successful at the beginning. And it's quite funny the way that they do it, because you know, you do think about the fact that you have this huge parachute that is falling on you, you know, and you know, it sort of makes sense that you wouldn't know how to actually get out of it. If you get because especially you think that you're disoriented at that point.
Right. And think about John in this point. Okay. You've barely survived. Okay. And at this point, I don't know if he knows the fire trucks are coming. So if I'm him, I got to get out of this parachute, because what's stopping them guys, if those fire trucks aren't coming, from rolling up on me now and shooting me to death? I got to get out of this parachute. He doesn't know where they are. He's a sitting duck, essentially, so on a flat ground where they can shoot him from a distance, even though they're probably missed still. But yeah, he doesn't know they retreated at this point. So yeah, they cut away. But if I'm John McClane, I got to get out of this freaking parachute. It's tangled up. I mean, I'm just waiting to get.
Well, he didn't know that they were going to be driving away in Randy Harlan's car. So, you know.
Randy Harlan's, yeah, that's true. Randy Harlan did try to kill him 5 seconds ago. So.
There you go. See, it's all cyclical.
getaway car was a direct.
That's right. Makes sense. Unfortunately, that's all we're going to talk about John this week, because the shot then changes, and we once again see the Northeast airline, you know, the jet flying. Now, why are you laughing? Because it's called Northeast?
Yeah, because it's Southwest, but I guess they didn't want to do that, so they went Northeast. We have an airline here called Southwest.
Yeah, Southwest is still flying, but you also have Northwest that's flying. And you know, I did research at the beginning of this season where they used to actually have a Northeast airline in the 1970s, and then it was bought up, I think, by Delta, if I remember correctly.
Would make sense. Delta, I would assume, is the biggest one.
You know, Delta is also the ones that sold the value jet to the value jet earlier this week. Oh, shit. So I don't know how much I trust Delta anymore. Yeah.
Well, to their credit, they retired them.
They retired them. When you retire someone, you don't expect someone to still use it, do you?
Yeah. No.
I think the idea is that, okay, that's it. We're putting you out the pasture. You know, I don't think.
See, the difference between a plane and a horse, I take that back. Never mind. I might even finish that thought.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, it's, you know, I wasn't referring to a horse at the time when I mentioned the plane to pasture, but I think you're right. That fits in there also. That wasn't even what I, you know, and I just saw City Slickers yesterday, so it makes sense, you know, but I don't know.
You're going for some Jack Palance action.
Right. That's right. Curly, he's a real cowboy. He sleeps with his eyes open. Yeah. So we see the plane flying in the air. Once again, you can easily see that this is a poorly done special effect shot from today's standards, but from, you know, from standards of 1990, it's actually quite good.
Would you put it above or below Airplane?
Well, Airplane is meant to keep it as a joke. So, you might know, because you know, in season two when I did Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the shot of the airplane is the one from the movie Airplane.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it's good enough to reuse.
It was good enough to reuse 7 years later for plane changes and automobiles. So I don't know. I guess so. It says something about it, maybe. I don't know. So do I think that this is – yes, I think this is a better job than they did have 10 years to perfect the special effects. Then we get a shot inside the cockpit of the Northeast Airlines, and they show us the co-pilot who is, you know, looking around suspiciously, and then we get a shot of the fuel gauge, and you know he's just looking and watching that it's getting very low. Now, what's the idea of the red hue of anytime they show a cockpit in this movie? You have any idea?
I would assume if you're going by like the old Italian filmmakers, red is danger. So you put red in a shot, you're gonna feel tense and you know stressed, and they're not casually flying the plane. So if they just lit it regularly, then you're gonna have to depend on the actors to convey, holy crap, we're about to fall out of freaking sky because we're out of gasoline. But, you know, you get character actors other than Cole Meany. You want to use somebody else. Just make it look dangerous in there. Make it look like a war room almost.
All right, that's fair. So we get a shot of this, and then we get another shot of the co-pilot, you know, licking his lips, trying to figure out what's going on. Then we get the navigator just playing with his pen.
You know, he's nervous, okay? He's
gonna fall. I got nothing better to do, so I'm just going to play with my pen. So I don't know. Now I want you to pay attention to something here. So when the first time they show us the fuel gauges, so we see that the number one main, okay, says that it has 112 on it, and the number two main has a 92 next to it. Okay. Now a few seconds later, after we see the navigator play with his pen, it goes back to the fuel gauges again, and now we see 3 and 4. So number 3 has 110. And number 4 has 116, so I think that they I think number 4 wins.
they got field midair, whatever. Every time I watch that shot, it's like that scene in the cockpit. It's the look the stewardess gives the pilot. For a brief moment, I'm like, are they gonna knock out this flight attendant? It seemed like they didn't want anybody to know that they're hiding the fact and that they're about to run out of fuel. So the pilot kind of, if you look at it again, she goes, you know, put on some TV, that'll calm them down. And she says, yeah, that's fine by me. And she kind of stops and she looks, and they share a look. And the briefest moment of that pilot's face, almost like,
yeah. Well, my first question is. That's right. My first question, even before that, is why is she going and talking to the co-pilot instead of the pilot? You know, the pilot is the one on the right, and the co-pilot's on the left. She goes to the co-pilot.
That's probably a flight. My mother was a flight attendant. I got to ask my mom. When you were a flight attendant, did you talk to?
You're only allowed to talk to the co-pilot.
But maybe only talking to the co-pilot. Don't look at me.
No, because also there's further proof that he's the co-pilot because he has 3 gold stripes on his shirt and the pilot has 4. So that.
Right, maybe the pilot is he's pretentious and he thinks he's better than everybody else. If you were to say anything to me, you tell it to my co-pilot. He'll relay the message. You're right next to him. What are you talking about?
Exactly. So then, you know, the stewardess walks in and she goes, she looks around, hears the beep, and she sees the light on for the fuel gauge. And then she goes, they're getting a little nervous back there. In fact, so am I. And then the co-pilot goes, well, we're right over Washington. See if you can get any TV. That'll settle them down. And then she like giggles for a second as she's looking around and goes, you know, you tell she's very nervous about what she's saying. And then she goes, it works for me. I'll. And then we get a little more beeping. You know, this is one of those things in movies, you know, they have a lot of beeping sounds and flashing lights and things like that, you know, just making sure that, you know, we get the danger here. You know.
Right.
But like here, I'll ask you a personal question. Okay, when you're driving in your car, and you know you see the light come on saying you got to get gas, do you get nervous, or do you get like, ah, I got plenty of time?
I get super. If I see that gauge, I failed. I try never to see that light. If I see that light, I'm like, oh no, I'm so not over prepared, but like. I don't like it when I'm at E. I know people who drive on E for like they're casual. Me, I'm like, I don't want to get stranded. One of my fears is being stuck on the side of the road. Flat tires and empty gas tanks terrify me. So when I'm like one above E, I get gas all the time. Cause it's just a tick I have, I guess. I don't know. But every time if I've ever gone to E, I'm like, oh, where am I? I gotta get to a gas station right away, and I know other people that are on E. They're like, "Yeah, I got like 50 miles. I'm gonna drive downtown. I'm whatever." I'm like, "You're on E, yeah, whatever."
Well, okay, just, yes. That's right. My wife gets really upset at me that I don't automatically fill up. You know, when it gets to the quarter mark.
I'm your wife.
That's right. When it gets to the quarter mark, she's like, "Okay, go fill up." And you know, I fill up my tank every 2.5 days. You know, I drive that much for work. And stuff like that. So I'm filling it up all the time. So I know how many miles I still have left, you know, each time. So I'm.
But you don't really know. You don't.
That's really true. That is true. And I gotta say that there were two times in my life when I got really scared about it. One time, this was probably at least 20 years ago, where I knew that I was driving on fumes getting into the gas station, and I was so happy when I finally got there. Because I really, every second I was like, okay, this car is just going to stop. Like you turn off the radio, you turn off the air conditioning.
You know, right. You don't turn on, you're driving with your windows open. You're kind of just half pushing the pedal.
That's right.
I don't like that. I'm stressed.
That's right. And this was like in the middle of the night also. And I was like really, really freaking out.
Oh, no.
And then there was another time when I think I was visiting my parents. After, you know, I was already in college or whatever, so I went to visit my parents, and I borrowed, you know, the spare car that the family had. In the spare car, the gas gauge didn't work properly. But what we would always do is we would, you know, when you'd fill up, you'd set it to zero, you know, and you knew on the counter how much you had and stuff like that. And so I went to go visit some friends, and on my way home, the car just conked out at me in like a really – I grew up in Detroit. Okay, or the suburbs of Detroit. Okay, so it conked out, you know, I guess you can say around 8 Mile, which, you know, anyone who's seen the Eminem movie has somewhat of an idea. And so I was a little concerned about where it was, and I was like, you know, the car conked out right in front of a gas station. It was like the perfect place for the car to conk out. I was like, oh crap,
lucky.
And I was like, lucky, right?
Lucky.
And like I was sitting there and I decided, okay, I'm going to wait a few minutes and see what happens. And so then what I did was, is, you know, I tried starting and the car wouldn't start, you know, cause I just wanted to get those extra few feet, you know, to get into to the gas station. So I got out of my car, went to the gas station, filled up a canister, brought it back, filled up the car, and then waited a few minutes. And I tried, you know, starting it again, didn't work. And I was starting to freak out at this point. I'm like, okay, maybe it's not the gas. Maybe it's something else. And then a police car shows up, okay? And these two cops get out. And again, this must have been 11, 12 o'clock at night, something like that. The cops get out and they go, do you have a problem, sir? You know, and I was like, well, you know, the car stopped working. I said, well, you know, you better call AAA and you better take care of this, because if you don't get rid of this car within the next like 2 hours, it won't be here anymore. Yeah, you know, it's not an area.
They love doing that.
So what
they love doing that. They do that with tire. If you have a flat tire, they're like, no, you can't drive on your rim. We'll tow your car.
No, right, they weren't talking about towing my car. They were talking about that it would get stolen because of the area that I was driving.
I keep forgetting where you are.
That's right. That's right. No, I'm not there now. But this is when I was in Detroit. And then what they did was they told me to put the car in neutral, and then they pushed me into the gas station itself, which was very nice to them. Then so I was getting ready to, and like I didn't want to call my parents and wake them up. I was like, great, I'm gonna have to tell my parents that I ran out of gas. That's what I need here, you know. So like I said, okay, I'm gonna wait a little while. So I waited like 15-20 minutes, and then I tried starting it and it worked, and I was like, okay, I drove straight back to my parents and you know, made sure that everything was okay. But yeah, I was a little scared for a few moments there, you know, about that whole thing.
We were talking about the value jet thing in the Everglades. Like I mentioned, Alligator Alley. That's like I hate that road because to get across from the east coast of Florida to the west coast, the quickest way is Alligator Alley. What they don't tell you is that, because it runs right through the Everglades, but they don't tell you there's no gas stations on Alligator Alley. And it's a long drive. So, and you can't get
Oh,
off.
wow.
Once you're on, that's it. There's no,
Do you see
so
those
a
signs
lot of
saying
people go on there.
last chance to fill up gas for 200
Yes, they're
miles?
around. Something like that. I mean, I haven't been on there for about a year. So because it's Everglades, there's not, you don't put gas stations in the Everglades. So there's no ever, there's no gas station there. So if you run out of gas there, you are royally screwed. And I have been on Alligator Alley and seen cars stuck on the side of the road that had to get towed because you can't, there's no gas station. You can walk, but you're going to be walking for tens of miles. I can't remember how many miles it is from one side to the other. I'm pretty sure it's 30. I'm not 100% sure. I'm just guessing. But yeah, sometimes it's like I'm not going to take it. If I take Alligator Alley, it's because I got a full tank of gas, a half a stick of bubble gum. It's dark. I'm wearing, like, I'm ready to go. But if I'm like iffy, nah, I'll take 95, I-95, which is a road that runs from here to New York or whatever. But there's stops on the way. Alligator Alley is like the shortcut, but to get you to I-75, which is the highway that runs on the west side of Florida. But honestly, I'd rather just not, because if anything happens, you're not just walking in like a residential neighborhood. You're walking through the Everglades at night for miles. So yeah, it's not that when you're talking about your car breaking down, that's one of my car breaking down for any reason, huge fear. If my dream is to live in a place where I don't need a car. My sister loves live hates New York and hates New Jersey, and I'm like, I love that because I don't need a
And
freaking
because also,
car because I do
you
not
don't
like
like
being
waking up in the
stranded.
middle of the night in the wrong seat of the car.
That too. It's also bad. Very
You
bad
see, DJ,
idea.
I remember your story.
It's happened before.
There.
It still haunts me. Jay Plummer still haunts me. I talked to him the other day. I was like, "Yeah, remember? Yeah, we always remember that. Yeah. We should be dead. We might be living in a simulation. We don't even know.
That's right. You're
I
both
have
in the
no idea.
matrix.
We're in the Matrix. I wouldn't doubt it. We shouldn't have made it."
Wow. Okay, so the co-pilot says to her, you know, "Why don't you turn on some TV?" And she goes, "Works for me." And then she turns around and starts walking out and goes, you know, she's like looks around. You know, I don't know how is that really supposed to make anyone feel a little safer, you know, because then she looks out and she
No.
sees the red light flashing, saying that there's no fuel on both left and right. And then the
Yeah.
co-pilot.
The pilot gives, that's when the pilot gives it again, that look like, shut your mouth. Don't you tell. Hey, look at me. Look at me. You don't say a freaking word to anybody. He doesn't say anything. He just gives it that look like,
That's
shut
right. The
up.
pilot. Yeah. Wait.
Don't
Not
say
a
a
word. Not a word.
word.
Not a word. Future boy. Not a word. Not a word.
Another word. Not a finger. Another word.
Not a word. Not a word. You're working for the Coast Guard Auxiliary. You're collecting money for Ah, you finally got it. Okay. I was waiting for you to get it. The Coast Guard Youth Auxiliary, that's what it is. Yeah. And then the shot changes and we get to see the symbol of the Nakatomi building or the Nakatomi company. You know, and we see the you know a folder that has Nakatomi on it. And we're back to Holly as she closes it, you know, whatever she was reading, now that she's the CEO of Nakatomi, because you know, her boss will not be joining us for the rest of his life.
For the rest of his life, yes, he's gone.
And then she like smiles at the woman sitting next to her and then looks over and sees Thornburg vigorously writing. We can now see that Thornburg is a lefty because he, you know, is writing from his left hand. And at the same time, he's listening to his Walkman.
Kids, a Walkman.
It's possible.
Maybe, probably. Now we've done this thing on our show before where I forget the name of the game, but it's like you pick one or the other. I think it's called one or the other. Which one do you, what did I say, like the most? Which one's the most of a jerk? Dick Thornburg or William Peck? Because it's the same guy, no, William Atherton, and they're both named after penises. So which one, Dick Thornburg or William Peck?
Which of them do I think is more annoying?
I guess it'd be the better question, right? Which is a bit more of a dick? More of a dick than Dick Thornburg? More of a jerk?
I would actually go with Peck, because Peck is doing it just for the sake of doing it. And
he's unleashes a biblical apocalypse.
Exactly. But, New York City. But Thornburg, at least, he's being very selfish here and thinking of himself. You know, Peck thinks he's actually doing the right thing. You know, he thinks he's saving the city with what he's doing.
So you think Dick Thornburg's more of a scumbag? But how is Dick more of a scumbag if Peck thinks he's doing the right thing? Dick's not doing the right thing. He's doing it for himself. Peck is doing to save the city, even though he's destroying the city with this horrible decision. But he thinks he's saving the city.
Good point. Okay, that's what I meant. That's what I meant. You see, I painted myself into the corner on that one. So yes, Thornburg.
One guy does release a supernatural biblical apocalypse upon the greater state of New York. The other guy puts a cop's wife in danger for ratings.
That's right. So there you go. Yeah. And the second thing he does is puts everyone in the airport in danger for the same reason. So, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
First scumbag. He's
it's Thornburg. Thornburg. Thornburg by a nose. Yeah.
By a nose. By a dick.
Man, that's true. Thornburg by a Richard.
Dick by a Richard. Dick. Richard by there a dick.
That's right. And then Holly, like, he smiles at Holly, and then Holly looks over and is getting a little concerned. She's not really sure what's going on. You know, she's getting suspicious. Mm-hmm.
Spider sense thing.
That's right. So the script has a few little things here. It starts off with the parachute is landing on the ground, billowing as something struggles under it. Then we hear McLean's muffled voice. Where's the fucking door? He staggers out from under the yards of silk covered in snow, fights the vertigo from his flight, and runs off. On Holly's plane at night, the stewardess sticks her head into the cockpit. They're getting pretty squirrely back there. In fact, so am I. The pilot says, we're right over Washington. See if you can get any TV. That'll settle them down. Works for me. Oh, and then so she stops. She's seen the fuel gauge almost on empty. She reacts. No one says anything. She composes herself and goes out. And then we're back into the business class. Holly types a line on her computer. Then she reacts to the sound of crumpling paper. Camera adjusts as she looks at Thornburg. He's listening to the tape recording with an earplug and then drafting his own document.
You think they changed the term squirrely because that's not a universal saying? You want to put it?
It's easier to say nervous.
Nervous, and you can put it. You can play it in any country, but if you say squirrely in, like, I don't know, Bangladesh, they don't know what the hell you're talking about. Like, what the hell's squirrely?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem, I would say.
Yeah,
I would agree with you on that. All right, so every Friday I have a segment called "Where Are They Up To This Weekend?"
Okay,
where I actually test my guests' memory of some of their favorite movies.
Okay.
So this movie, we've now reached the 80-minute point. So this is 1 hour and 20 minutes into it. All right. So I asked DJ before recording to give me the names of three of his top movies. And now we're going to see how well he really knows those movies.
Okay.
All right. So let's start with The Way of the Gun.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. From 2000. What do you think is happening at the 80-minute mark?
Oh, frick. Okay, wait a minute. Let me go.
Wait, you thought I was going to make this easy?
I was like, you're going to ask me a question about the movie. 80-minute mark.
I am. What's going on at the 80-minute mark?
Let me think. Okay. The kid. They beat up Sarah Silverman in the beginning, and then they did a kidnapping. That's about 20 minutes. I'd say they are at Benicio del Toro's at the convenience store. No. That's the 80-minute mark. Ugh, movie's not long. Benicio's talking to James Caan at the bar.
First of all, the movie's 120 minutes, so you still got another 40 minutes to the movie, just so you know.
Yeah. I don't think the shootout's happened yet. I think, is Benicio talking to James Caan at the bar?
No.
About Judy? Oh, crap, I got nothing. I don't know what happens with Danny.
Okay, Juliette Lewis basically staggers out of...
she's having the baby. Yeah, she's having... Oh, God dang. Good movie, guys. Watch that Way of the Gun, Christopher McQuarrie. Movie. First directorial debut of him.
All right, next one. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. What is going on at the 1 hour and 20 minute point of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
Is Tuco taking a bath?
No.
I know Tuco's thinking, don't talk, shoot. I don't know.
It's where the officer takes a telescope and starts looking out at all the Southern prisoners.
They're about to blow up the... Oh, wait, this is before the interrogation scene.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That movie's hard to gauge because there's a lot of, like, vignette segments where we're in the town. Now we're in the desert. Now Tuco's talking to his priest brother. Now we're in the, you know. Right. Yeah, okay.
And the most interesting fact about that 120 minute mark or 1 hour and 20 minute mark is that it is exactly the halfway point of The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And the final one is Die Hard.
Oh, I'm not going
to
get this.
Okay. You were the very first person to choose this. And I was very pleased to see that it's on. You know, that it's here. What do you think is going on at the 80-minute mark?
Is the quarterback toast at this point?
The quarterback is toast for a long time already.
Oh, wow. 80-minute mark. It's a two-hour
movie. Quarterback and toast happens at the 15-minute mark. Come on.
Is McClain shooting...
quarterback and toast is when they shoot the... No, that happens.
Get the car.
Yeah. That was, I think, around the one-hour mark, if I remember correctly.
Is McClane shooting Honda through the door?
Nope.
You know what I'm talking about, the guy from Lethal Weapon. I forget. I think his name is Honda or something.
No, you're talking about
the Asian guy. Guy that eats the Crunch Bar. I think his name is Hondo.
His name isn't Hondo. Hondo's from Spawn.
It's something like that. It's like it's gonna bother me. The guy that eats the Crunch Bar. Guy from Lethal Weapon that tortures. Rigs with the car battery.
Yeah, which you know, Mark and I talked about it. That it's possible that they are twin brothers.
Same person. Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Have a little bit of a problem with that because of this movie actually proves that that's not possible. Because
blown away.
No, because in this movie, when they're sitting on the plane, they actually see an advertisement for Lethal Weapon, Lethal Weapon 2, which means that they can't be. It can't be that they're in the same universe.
Unless they made a novelization of something that happened, huh?
That is possible. That is possible.
They could have done that.
I think you're right about that. I like that. I was. You're talking about Al Leong.
Yeah, but what's his character's name?
Uli.
I thought he had like a name. I got to go.
No, in this movie, he's known as Uli, and in Lethal Weapon, he's Endo.
Endo. That's the name I'm thinking of. I keep thinking Honda. It's Endo. I apologize. Yeah.
End
up. He's not getting shot through the door by McClane, is he?
No. The 80-minute mark is when our good friend Ellis comes to make a deal.
Guys?
He comes to make a deal.
Oh, that's a good 80. That's a good mark right there. That's one of the greatest scenes in the movie.
Yes.
Hey, John Boy.
John Boy. that's
one of, hey, John Boy. Hey, this is radio, not television. Put the gun away. That's one of the greatest scenes in the movie, man. All right.
I'm not a method actor. What am I, method actor?
I'm a method actor, Hans. What are you, a method actor, Hans? I.E., you won something. Sprinkle see talk? What are you talking about?
That's
such
right.
A good scene.
Yes, it is.
Matthew Stewart, my co-host, who has the Ellis beard, when we were doing a Die Hard sketch, I was like, well, you got to be Ellis. You don't sound like him, but you look exactly like him, so we're going with that. You look exactly like him. We had an 80s party and he dressed like Ellis and we got powdered sugar and we put it on his beard to make him look like he was doing cocaine. He looks just like him. If you ever look up Matthew Stewart, he has the Ellis beard, which is fantastic. He looks fantastic. I go, Matthew, cool. If I was you, every Halloween I'm Ellis. Every Halloween.
All right, great. So you want to, for one last time, tell people where they can find you.
Simplistic Reviews, simplistic.reviews is our website. Simplistic Reviews, you just search that on YouTube, Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes, Spotify, all the places where podcasts are found. You'll find us. And every, I think yesterday, the 1st of July, we released every 1st of every month, we release our regular show. And then 15th, we release like a short show, 15-minute show. And then every 20th, we release a movie commentary. And I think we're going to be doing, God, I really hope not. We're going to be probably doing The Flash. I really don't want to do The Flash because I don't like that movie at all. But we only do bad movies. And spoiler alert, The Flash ain't great. So, yeah, we're probably doing The Flash soon.
All right. Enjoy. Thank you very much for that. And
I won't.
Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. So, DJ, thank you very much for joining me. I had a great time this week. I hope you did too. And what's more important is I hope that all of our listeners did too.
My pleasure as always.
All right. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here